Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025. As always, we begin with today's top stories. The first headline reads, Pope Francis, an appreciation. That's Pope Francis, F-R-A-N-C-I-S. Most of all, mercy and compassion. We asked the Reverend Patrick O'Neill, N-E-A-L, O'Neill, pastor at St. Patrick in Tolono and St. Joseph in Ivesdale, how he'll remember Pope Francis, who died Monday at the age of 88. I awoke on Easter Monday to very sad news. Like all Catholic priests, I had gone through the marathon of Holy Week with all of the various liturgies, which are spiritually and emotionally moving, but also physically exhausting. Easter Sunday night, after the parish masses, I relaxed, watching the classic Cecil B. DeMille film, Ben-Hur, then settled in for a good night's sleep. After waking Monday morning, I dressed and prayed, fed my cats and made my morning coffee, then turned on the television only to be met with the news that Pope Francis had died. I was stunned, yet I could see it coming. I had watched the recorded Easter Sunday Mass from the Vatican and the Urbi et Orbi blessing following the Vatican Mass on Sunday, once I had celebrated Easter Masses at my two parishes. I was struck by how tired Pope Francis looked when he came out to be driven through the crowd in St. Peter's Square and when he gave the pontifical blessing from the loggia of the basilica. In seeing him, I thought of how St. John Paul II looked in the last days of his pontificate. Both he and Francis looked so very, very tired. Both men were beset by multiple health issues as well as old age, yet continued to serve to the best of their abilities. The weight of the papacy is deadly indeed. The late Pope Benedict XVI, in his old age and frailty, decided to lay down that burden and resigned, living the remainder of his life in praying for his successor, Pope Francis, and for the worldwide church. Many news commentators have and will comment on Pope Francis's legacy. Some will use the political terms of liberal or conservative, either one, quote-unquote, to try and define him. Those terms are ill-suited for use in any religion, but especially in terms of papacy. More traditional elements in the church and the world have seen Pope Francis as too progressive, quote-unquote, and more progressive elements will complain that he was too traditional. What either side fails to see is that Francis, and any pope for that matter, cannot change the doctrine of the faith. That being said, what Pope Francis did for the church was to remind us all that, yes, doctrines are important, but people are of paramount importance. Without watering down any doctrine, Francis did not shrink from letting everyone know that whatever their state in life, whatever their faults and failures, they were beloved children of God. He was not afraid to speak off the cuff, from the heart, as it were. Sometimes that was confusing for some. Perhaps that's why some people were so opposed to him and his methods. For centuries, the world was used to hearing strictly defined and elegantly worded decrees from the popes. Those are important to the Catholic faith and necessary, but we must remember that first and foremost, Pope Francis was a pastor. From his days as a Jesuit scholastic and later as a priest, he gave himself to working with ordinary people, especially the poor. He continued that as the Cardinal Archbishop, of Buenos Aires. He lived simply, used public transport, and even filled in for his parish priests when they needed to take a holiday. As a Jesuit, a member of the Society of Jesus, founded by St. Ignatius of Loyola, he had taken the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. He continued to live these as an archbishop and a cardinal, once called the princes of the church. There was nothing princely about him even during his papacy. I remember watching him once come onto the loggia of St. Peter's Basilica after his election 12 years ago. Rather than wearing the lace rochette, a type of shortened alb, which is a liturgical garment, and the red mozzetta, a liturgical garment signifying jurisdiction. He appeared wearing only the white papal cassock. Unlike previous newly elected popes who came out with a beaming smile, Francis looked a bit shy, if not stunned. Then he did something I had never witnessed before. He asked the crowd in St. Peter's Square and those watching around the world to pray for him and bowed his head in silence. That profoundly moved me, seeing that humility. From day one of his papacy, he changed how things were done at the Vatican. He paid his hotel bill at the Casa Santa Marta in person. He chose to remain living there rather than in the spacious but rather cold institutional apostolic palace. He chose to continue wearing his black orthotic shoes rather than the oxblood papal slippers. He made it clear to the world that the pomp and splendor of the papacy was not dear to his heart. Hopefully those things helped us all to ask ourselves if we could live more simply and humbly. He inherited many problems that previous papacies had faced and tried his best to answer them. The issues of scandals in the church, the rise of extremist religious violence, the reform of the Roman Curia, the various Vatican organizations, interreligious dialogue, continuing conflicts in the world, climate change, among other issues. Did he do so perfectly? No. No one, man, could, but he did his best. He chose to reach out to the peripheries, as he called them, to countries where Catholics were a minority, to the poor, the homeless, the imprisoned, the sick, the migrants, the overlooked and despised. He reminded the Church that governance and pastoral care should be done first by listening, and that has upset many. If nothing else, in his own person, he reminded us that we are imperfect persons who are loved by God and called to live holiness by loving one another. He did not ignore human sin, but proclaimed that God's mercy and grace is far greater, and those can change us. History will evaluate his papacy with more clarity than you or I could do, since it has the advantage of time and impersonal distance. Yet I think we can all say that Pope Francis was a true pastor, a true bridge builder, which is what the title pontiff means. It seems clear to me, at least, that he did his best to mold his heart after the heart of Christ and shared that mercy and compassion to those who needed it most. He comforted the afflicted and afflicted the comfortable, and that is what Christianity should do. His 12 years as vicar of Christ and successor of St. Peter was or will have lasting effects for many years to come. May God reward this humble shepherd and grant him eternal life, happiness, and peace. Rest in peace, Your Holiness. And there's a photograph that appears in this article, too. One is of Reverend Patrick O'Neill, an older Caucasian gentleman with glasses and a white and gray beard in his priest's outfit uniform. And then there's a picture of Pope Francis talking in front of a few people at a podium. And that caption reads, "Nuns stand in St. Peter's Square to watch the first Mass by Pope Francis on a giant screen in 2013 at the Vatican." That photo is provided by Getty Images. The next headline reads, "Champaign City Council, vote tonight on plan to buy, remodel downtown building." This article is written by Jana Wiersema. She can be reached at jwiersema@newsgazette.com. This article is based out of Champaign. The city of Champaign is proposing to spend $5.95 million to purchase and renovate an existing downtown building for city use. The Champaign City Council plans to vote on a resolution authorizing the purchase of 201 West University Avenue for $3.1 million at its meeting tonight. The city also plans to budget $25,000 for closing costs on the deal and $2.825 million for renovations. Should the council direct staff to proceed, we will be evaluating the proper relocation of departments through a needs assessment, Economic Development Manager TJ Blakeman told the News Gazette. The report to the City Council outlines some of the recent council actions that affect various departments that would be considered in that assessment. Assuming the purchase is approved, the city would assume ownership of the existing lease with Chase Bank. The sale would also include a parking lot south of the bank building. Blakeman wrote in a report to the council that there have been overcrowding issues in the city building for some time, which has led to employees sharing workspaces and working out of departments other than their own. The city also leased most of the office building at 205 West Park Avenue to house the Equity and Engagement Department and Neighborhood Services, which mitigated the problem somewhat. However, recent city council actions will soon increase staff located in the city building, as well as at 205 West Park Avenue, Blakeman said. He explained that the council has given the okay for staff to move forward with year two of the downtown entertainment pilot program. The plan includes a full-time events coordinator within the planning and development department, but this individual is currently working out of the IT department because of a lack of space. Additionally, the City Council has directed staff to implement a mental health emergency response model, which necessitates the hiring of at least five new city employees who will be part of the Equity and Engagement Department. Blakeman also noted that a recent Development Services audit recommended co-locating the Planning and Development Department and the Building Safety Division to provide more streamlined and efficient services to the development community. Per Blakeman's report, the building contains a total of 30,900 square feet. This includes the first floor, which is about 9,700 square feet, and is leased to Chase Bank. The vacant second floor is 11,300 square feet and was most recently occupied by F.E. Moran Security Systems and later Securitas after it acquired F.E. Moran. The 9,900 square foot basement is divided between the bank and vacant office space. The basement housed the security company's server room and call center, which served its nationwide clientele and represents an opportunity to accommodate the expanding space needs of the city's IT department's computer network server equipment from the city building, Blakeman wrote. The space also has potential as a location for the city's emergency operations center due to the size, central location, access to emergency backups, and IT infrastructure. The city is targeting May 6th as a closing date. However, it will be about 6 months before the property is ready for occupancy, as both city staff and consultants from Farnsworth Group have said that the site is in need of some renovations. Their inspections showed that the building would require some capital expenditures, including elevator repair, a new roof, replacement of electrical panels, replacement of some of the HVAC units, and fiber connection costs to connect the building to the city's network, Blakeman said. Other capital costs include a security system, remodeling bathrooms for ADA compliance, reconfiguring office areas, moving costs, IT costs, and a 10% contingency. City staff recommend using the general fund to purchase the property and transferring dollars from this fund to the facility fund to cover the cost of these capital improvements. Blakeman noted that the city is expected to collect rent and common area expenses of about $325,000 a year, but will also incur recurring costs of a little over $320,000 annually from operating the building. He added that the Building and Property Maintenance Division of the Public Works Department is understaffed, quote-unquote, and would need a new employee in order to add the property to its workload. The recurring cost of the new position and vehicle replacement expenses is estimated at $110,000, and there would also be a one-time cost of $54,000 for a vehicle purchase. The additional revenue and associated expenses will be added to next year's budget, Blakeman said. However, as the building purchasing process is set to close in early May, City staff recommend a budget amendment in the current fiscal year to cover the non-personnel related cost of the building for the final 2 months of the fiscal year. The recommended budget amendment for May and June 2025 is approximately $35,000. Blakeman noted that as the property is held in a trust, the seller will work to get approval of the deal from the trust's beneficiaries, which may involve approval by probate court. The bank building is owned by 201 West University LLC, with state business records listing Bonnie Stanton as the LLC's manager. In February, Stanton filed a lawsuit against her stepson, local developer Hans Grotelischen, regarding his management of the property and LLC funds. Stanton is the trustee of Trust A and B of her late husband, Arden Grotelischen. In the complaint, Stanton's counsel alleges that Grotelischen has held himself out to Bonnie as a certified public accountant and advised her in 2019 to buy the property using Trust A so that the trust could grow. Hans had another interest in the acquisition of the Chase Bank building, as it had ample parking, which would have benefited the ice hockey rink proposal backed by Hans for downtown Champaign, wrote attorneys Charles Lefebvre and Richard Kloss. Hans has also proposed that he be appointed as the property manager for the Chase Bank building. Stanton alleges that Grotelischen used the position to divert over $1 million from the LLC's income into his own accounts, repaid about $930,000 without accounting for interest, and kept a little over $215,000 from these unauthorized withdrawals. She also claims that Grotelischen further diverted funds to himself by causing the LLC to pay vendors and utilities for services provided to Hans or other businesses owned or controlled by Hans. As a result of Hans' unauthorized withdrawals from the LLC and other acts of maleficence, the LLC lacked sufficient funds and did not pay its property taxes and other obligations under the LLC's mortgage, Stanton's counsel wrote. Stanton learned of these failures only after receiving a notice of default from the LLC's lender, Busey Bank, in December 2023. The complaint also alleges that Hans failed to maintain the building and collect rent from tenants. Grotelischen has yet to file a response. Stanton filed a motion to approve a sale of real estate for the property at 201 West University Avenue last Wednesday. The sales agreement with the city is contingent upon the approval by this court of the contemplated sale, unless such approval is waived due to the approval of the trust beneficiaries, her attorneys wrote, adding that Stanton has asked Grotelischen and his sister, Teresa Westman, to approve the sale, but neither have done so. A hearing on the motion is scheduled for May 7th. The siblings have filed a separate suit against Stanton over alleged misuse of their father's trust, which she disputes. And there's a photograph that accompanies this article. It's an exterior photo of a very large, looks like two-story, boxy, but lots of windows building. The caption reads, "The City of Champaign plans to buy 201 West University Avenue while continuing to lease space to Chase Bank." That photo is provided by Robin Scholes, S-C-H-O-L-Z, of the News Gazette. The next headline reads, it's actually a very large photo, front and center, A section, front page of the paper, Boston Marathon, happy anniversary. There is a woman in a wheelchair, there's a front wheel and two side wheels, crossing the finish line of a race on a sunny day. The caption reads, "University of Illinois graduate Susanna Scaroni, S-C-A-R-O-N-I, breaks the tape to win the women's wheelchair division during the Boston Marathon on Monday. That was yesterday. Her victory came 50 years after wheelchair racing was introduced at Boston and added to the U of I's impressive totals at the famous springtime race. Scaroni won her second Boston title by beating favorite Catherine De Brunner by more than 2 minutes. Susanna had a phenomenal race, U of I coach Adam Bleakney said. It was a big upset and a huge win for her. And that photo is provided by Charles Krupa of the Associated Press. Congratulations to Susanna, S-U-S-A-N-N-A-H, Scaroni, S-C-A-R-O-N-I. She's won multiple races and awards over the years. The next headline reads, University of Illinois, another U of I professor sees her funding vanish. This article is written by Luke Taylor. Luke can be reached at L-T-A-Y-L-O-R at newsgazette.com. This article is based out of Urbana. After her hard-won federal funding for humanities research was stripped away, one University of Illinois professor says her future plans are uncertain. Julie Turnock, T-U-R-N-O-C-K, isn't the only professor losing funding, and she says the impacts will ripple far beyond the scope of the research projects being canceled. Universities are clearly in danger of losing both the people and the knowledge that those people produce, Turnock said. She's a professor of media and cinema studies, as well as the director of the Roger Ebert Center for Film Studies. So she references a famous Ebert quote, "The movies are like a machine that generates empathy." Humanities teaches us critical skills. Critical thinking skills help us determine the value of different kinds of approaches and thoughts and being in the world, Turnock said. If our critical thinking skills are undermined, our society suffers. Turnock was at a Society for Cinema and Media Studies conference when a colleague checked her email, to learn that her own grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities had been rescinded, though she had already received some installments of the funding. Turnock began checking her own email, but it wasn't until days later, on April 7th, that another colleague recommended checking her spam folder. There it was, an email from NEH Acting Chair Michael McDonald, using a different email server than the .gov addresses NEH typically contacted her from. He informed Turnock that her grant no longer effectuates the agency's needs and priorities and conditions of the grant agreement and is subject to termination, Turnock said, reading from the email. This grant was intended to cover travel and lodging for Turnock near multiple film archive sites in Los Angeles, including the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, as well as an archive in Provo, Utah. Her specific area of research was to be on special effects in Hollywood from around 1920 to 1960, a topic Turnock says has not been covered much. Getting the grant in the first place wasn't easy, with NEH only approving about 5% of the requests it received annually. It's like getting into Harvard. It's very, very rare to get an NEH grant, and I was fortunate enough to get one of the individual grants, Turnock said. When she learned she would receive the grant, Turnock had just completed a sabbatical, so she delayed the start of the funding so she wouldn't take 2 consecutive years away from the U of I. Turnock's $60,000 grant was among $33.8 million awarded by NEH during last year's cycle, enough to fund 260 humanities projects. She remembers asking if anything would change since a presidential election would occur during the funding started, before the funding started going to her, and the people she worked with at NEH assured her the funds had already been requisitioned for this purpose, so they couldn't be taken back. There aren't very many organizations that fund humanities research, and many universities are reducing spending as they await further impacts of federal changes under presidential Donald Trump's administration. So Turnock has few options to turn to for financial support. Within days of her grant being terminated, around 80% of the staff at NEH were terminated, meaning Chernock isn't sure who to turn to for answers about what happened to hers and others' grants either. At least two other U of I faculty members she's aware of are facing similar losses of NEH grants. We are encouraged to go out and get grants, and the university relies on that to a great degree. So to have this really important source of funding cut is really devastating to humanities research, which has already been under attack for the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years, Chernock said. It just makes it that much harder for us to do our job, and our job is to put knowledge into the world. Without that, I don't know what we are as a society. And there's a photograph of Julie Chernock. She's a Caucasian woman, glasses, in her 50s, I would say. The next headline reads, "Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso." That's J-I-M, last name Rosso, R-O-S-S-O-W. On the 50th anniversary of wheelchair racing at the Boston Marathon, it was only fitting that the University of Illinois produced another champion. That we've had such a long tradition of success here makes this a really cool year, said U of I coach Adam Bleakney, that's B-L-E-A-K-N-E-Y, who was at the finish line when Susanna Scaroni won Monday's women's race. The University of Illinois is a recognized name. Winning Boston for the second time, Scaroni joined the likes of Jean Driscoll, that's J-E-A-N, Driscoll, D-R-I-S-C-O-L-L, Tatiana McFadden, and Daniel Romanchuk as multiple-time champs with Illini ties. Bleakney and his Illini racers, four men, four women, celebrated as they always do when in Boston with lunch at Whole Foods Market. "Anytime our athletes win a marathon major, it's significant," Bleakney said. "But Boston is a special place." Bleakney and many of the Illini were due back in town early this morning. Scaroni, meanwhile, was to fly overseas to compete in this weekend's London Marathon. A year ago, she participated in the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon, but this year's schedule didn't work out. "It was a great day for everybody," said Bleakney, impressed by the support his racers received during the race. "You heard I-L-L, I-N-I throughout the course, which was amazing." And there's a photograph of Bleakney and Scaroni at the race. He's kind of standing near her, coaching her, I imagine. The photograph is courtesy of Adam Bleakney. The caption reads, "The U of I's Susanna Scaroni celebrates after winning Monday's Boston Marathon." Congratulations to Susanna Scaroni for winning again. And questions, comments, suggestions, what say you? You can always reach out to Jim Rosso at J-R-O-S-S-O-W at newsgazette.com. Next up, history. Area history. In 1925, the unopposed Republican ticket made a clean sweep in Urbana's city election. Dr. W.F. Burress, B-U-R-R-E-S, was elected mayor with 854 votes in 1975, two bills designated to reduce the operating costs of the Public Defender's Office have been introduced by State Senator Stanley Weaver, a Republican from Urbana. And in 2010, Champaign City Manager Steve Carter announced that Dan Norbitz, N-O-R-B-I-T-S, 39, will have to take a month off without pay because he violated police department policy about keeping control of his weapon when he shot Kwani Carrington, 15, on October 9th. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been the reading of the News Gazette for today. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back to read part two with you shortly. Please stay with me. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful day.